Thank you for listening to this sermon recorded at the Lost River Church of Christ. For more information, check out our website at lostriverchurch.org or call us at 270-843-3163. We consider it an honor to share the good news of Jesus Christ with you completely free of charge. Have a great day and enjoy the sermon. If you have a Bible and you want to follow along, we're going to be reading a few moments from Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17, so you can be turning there. While you're doing that, I want to announce that we're beginning a new short series of lessons today on how to overcome doubt or dealing with the doubts that we often struggle with in our faith. And tonight, or this morning, we're going to try to kind of just clear away some basic misconceptions and then move on to laying a more of a foundation for building that faith in subsequent weeks. And I want to tell you that part of the reason for doing a series like this is, it's good therapy for me personally, because I'm by nature sort of a skeptical person. I typically want to say when somebody makes a claim, okay, fine, prove it. There's a couple of illustrations, I guess, about myself I could use of that. People ask, you know, why don't you get a new truck, Lawrence? Your truck is an embarrassment. And I'll admit that, and there may be a lot of reasons I could give. You know, financially, it's, you know, not a good time or whatever. But I think deep down, the real answer to it is all these newfangled vehicles, I don't trust them. Okay, if it doesn't have at least 250,000 miles on it, you know, why would you want to get in that thing and count on it to get you somewhere? This one has gotten me all kinds of places over and over again. So I've got a lot of faith in it because of a track record of reliability. Another thing, you know, the essential oil craze is going on right now. There's some interesting things about that. I don't understand all about that. My tendency, again, just naturally, is to be skeptical. Janice, on the other hand, she really gets into all that. And so we've kind of got a good deal. She doesn't have to tell me all the things that this particular oil does, but anytime she wants to rub oil on me, I'm good with that. I'm good with that. I may not believe all the things about it, but it's a good thing, so I'm good with that. But I am by nature a little bit skeptical, and you may be too. You may be too, and you may be skeptical when it comes to matters of what we refer to as religious faith. And I know the truth about some of you. Some of you are here today because it's, you know, it's Easter Sunday and your mom asked you to come, so you're here. But I'll take that, because the Bible says, Jesus says, to obey your mother. And so I'm going to say you're here because Jesus told you to be here. And I'll take that as a starting place. And I hope that as we consider these things today, that it might whet your appetite and you'll want to come back and hear some more things as we try to lay a foundation for our faith in the weeks that are ahead. I know that many of us do struggle with biblical and questions with regard to God and faith and the church. But I am glad that you're here. And if that's you, I'm glad especially that you're here. You're welcome here. This is a place for you. And if you think, well, no, church is a place for people who are devoted believers. And I have more questions than I do beliefs. And I would say that, you know, we're still here for you, that this is still a place for you. Church membership, baptism is a place for people who have made the commitment, I'm going to follow Jesus wherever he leads. But that doesn't mean that you have to make that commitment in order to come here. It doesn't mean that you have to make that commitment to be accepted by people around here as friends. We'd love to get to know you. We'd love to help you. If you have some things you need help with, we'd be glad to do that. If you have questions you'd like to ask, if you'd like to get your kids involved with some other great kids and send them to Bible classes and things like that, we'd be honored to have you participate in that. You know, when Jesus was walking this earth, and we have the record of people who knew him and saw him and were part of all of that, as they were there, they described for us a people who were surrounding Jesus who had all different levels of faith and belief. Some of them were just really curious, intrigued, but skeptical and doubtful, and yet Jesus invited them to follow him. And that's all we ask you to do, is just come along, investigate, consider, think about these things, and we would be happy to make friends with you along the way. And even if you're here this morning, you're saying, I'm not even sure that I believe that there is a God. Well, as a matter of fact, you're in good company because many of us also don't believe in many gods. In fact, I want to begin this morning by showing you an example of what I mean. I've never done this before. Beginning a lesson by quoting a well-known atheist, Richard Dawkins makes the statement, we are all atheists about most of the gods that human history has ever believed in. I think he accurately describes the situation there. I'm pretty sure that nobody here this morning, you can raise your hand if you want, you don't have to, but I'm pretty sure this morning that nobody here came because they wanted to come and worship the god Ra. Okay? There was once a time in this world that the most advanced civilization in the earth worshipped the god Ra. That's what the Egyptians called their sun god. Or probably none of you came here to worship Anu, a Mesopotamian deity. And none of you came here this morning because you think Zeus is just the greatest. And you really want to worship the thunderbolt god of Zeus of the Greeks. And as a matter of fact, it may surprise you as well that one of the earliest criticisms that Christians and the early church faced in the Roman Empire was the charge of atheism. Christians were identified as being atheists because they did not believe in the gods of the Roman pantheon. They would not worship the pagan altars or burn incense to the emperor of Rome who they deified. And so the Christians were tagged as being atheists. They didn't believe in the gods of the Romans. And I think that we get some insight as to what that means when we look to Acts chapter 17 and we see an example of what we're talking about. We see that they worshiped a god, the Christians worshiped a god different from those of the culture that they lived in, but it doesn't mean that they didn't believe in any god. And so let's consider that for a moment. I'm going to put the passage up on the screen if you want to read there. It says that Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, let's pause there for a moment. The Areopagus was a place in the city of Athens, a mountain, a hillside, that was a place where all the intellectuals, the Stoic and Epicurean philosophers gathered there. People who were heads of state would gather there and discuss ideas and religion and philosophy. And that's what they did there all the time. And Paul was visiting the city of Athens, and they said, you're saying some things we haven't heard before. We want to hear what you have to say. So Paul was invited to come there and to speak at this rather exalted location. And he said to them, men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. So they had a lot of different gods. And Paul, who was an apostle of Jesus Christ, that means he was an ambassador sent by Christ as a witness of Christ to testify about the things he had seen and heard from Christ. He says, I come to you and I'm presenting to you a God very different from all of these other gods that I see you worshiping. All these idols that you've erected to these gods. But curiously, they had this one altar that was dedicated to the unknown God. Just in case we missed one, we want to make sure we don't offend anybody unnecessarily. And so here's an altar to the unknown God. Paul very cleverly takes hold of that and says, yeah, there's one you don't know about who's really the one who's over everything else. He's the one I want to talk to you about. I proclaim him to you. And so here's his proclamation of him. He says, he's the God who made the world and everything in it. He's not one of the gods. He is the God, the creator God of heaven and earth. And being Lord of heaven and earth, he does not live in temples made by man. So there's this tendency for us to make these temples, to house our idols that we have concocted and thought through. This is what God is probably like. And Paul's saying, no, the God I'm proclaiming to you is not like that. He's not made or served by human hands as though he needed anything. He doesn't need us, but he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward Him and find Him. Yet He is actually not far from each one of us. For in Him we live and move and have our very being, even as some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed His offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. Man can't imagine the God that Paul's proclaiming. In order to craft an idol, you first have to have some imagination that you create of what God is like, and then you apply your hands to some material that you believe will be in some way an apt reflection of this God that you have imagined. And Paul says, no, I'm not talking about anything like that. He goes on. And he says, now the time of ignorance, in times of ignorance, God overlooked. But now He is commanding all people everywhere to repent, to turn away from these idols that come from men's imaginations and turn to Him, the true and living God, because He has fixed the day on which He will judge the world in righteousness. Some people immediately hear that and they hear judge in righteousness and they just think of a negative thought. But do you think the world is messed up? Do you think there's problems in the world? Do you think there's things that need to be made right and fixed and wrongs that need to be corrected? God's promising here. Paul says the God he's preaching promises that there will be a day come when He is going, when He's going to make things right. And He's given us evidence of this. He's going to judge the world by a man that He has appointed. And He has given us evidence of this by raising Him from the dead. Now we'll come back to that hopefully next week. But we see here that what's going on with the Apostle Paul is he's claiming that the gods that they worship and the God that he's proclaiming are two very different things. And I have a thesis that I want to share with you this morning, and that is that when many people walk away from their faith, they think they're walking away from the biblical God, the God that Paul proclaimed, the God that Jesus came and claimed to be in the flesh. They think that they are walking away from that, when in reality they are walking away from an idol. They're walking away from something they have imagined to be the God of the Bible, but then in very important ways is actually quite different from the God of the Bible. The way that this happens for most of us follows a similar pattern. We tend to grow up and we hear Bible stories and we're told some Bible facts. And our parents, our Bible class teachers, the culture at large, we learn these stories as children. And what happens is too often we have this child's concept of God, but then we grow up in life and we mature and we begin to experience life in a more full and complete way, but we retain a very, very childlike concept of who God is. And then as we get a little bit older, maybe we reach high school age or we go off to college and we begin to have this problem of the reality that I'm seeing in the world and the realities that I'm experiencing in my life are not squaring with this concept of God that I had as a child and that I remain that remains with me to this very day. And so gradually, the Sunday school concept of God doesn't fit with their perception of reality. They do at least remember, however, and this may be your case, they do remember that God said to be honest. And so in order to maintain some sense of honesty and integrity, we jettison God in order to hold on to what we think of as reality. Others compartmentalize. They maintain their childlike understanding of God. And they hold on to their faith, but they sort of just put the two in different categories. And they don't, you know, there's the real world I live in and function in, and then there's this God that I kind of think of in a different way over here. Does that describe you? My question for you this morning is, are you sure that the God that you're walking away from the God that you have left behind, or the God that you have marginalized and compartmentalized, is actually the God that Paul is talking to these people about in Athens? Or is it perhaps still this childlike understanding of God? Now, I want to back up on that and make sure I don't leave a false impression. It's okay to have a childlike understanding of God when you're a child, right? And it's not that people necessarily have been lied to about God when they were children. It's that a child has a limitation on what he can understand about anything in life, and certainly about the most difficult and biggest thing imaginable, which is God himself. You don't teach a third grader who's going through some kind of a life science class the same thing about science or the human body that you teach a third year medical student. And it's not that you were lying to the third grader when you were teaching him. It's just that you had to accommodate the knowledge level that he had at the time that you were teaching him. And we have to do that with our children as we try to explain God to them. But again, the problem is sometimes we reach then adulthood and we have still retained this very childish concept of God, and it doesn't anymore really fit exactly with our understanding of the world. And now comes this conflict. And so, again, the question is, are you sure that the God that you left really is the full-orbed God of the Bible? Or could it be an idol, a child's concept of God that never grew up and kept pace with your understanding of the rest of reality? Let's consider some of the childhood gods, the misconceptions, the imaginations of God we might would describe as idols that are very common for us to be stuck with as we reach maturity and create big problems for us. The first of these is what we might call the guardrail God. I heard somebody else refer to God as the bodyguard God. I think that's a good way of putting it as well. But he is the God who makes sure that nothing bad happens to you. He especially makes sure that nothing bad happens to you if you are good. Okay, so you be good. You know, no drinking, no dancing. You say your prayers. You go to church. You obey your mother and father. You don't hang out with the wrong kind of girls. You do all these things. You follow these rules. And you can be sure that then God will take care of you. He will make sure that nothing bad happens to you as you go through life. And then you know what happens next. Because for some of you, this is the very story that you could tell. You did these things. You kept the rules. You tried to be good. And you were a pretty good kid. And then suddenly, believing that God was going to take care of you because you had been this good kid, something tragic happened in your life. And Railguard God allowed you to go off the road, skid off the road and go over the cliff. He wasn't there for you the way that you thought he was going to be. For some people, a parent dies or you become very ill yourself, or some other tragic set of circumstances happens in your life and suddenly you are very disappointed and disillusioned. And so you end up saying, well, the God I believed in wasn't real, wasn't true. He wasn't there for me, at least. And so I'm out of here. And so you walk away, thinking you're walking away from the God of the Bible, when in reality you're walking away from one of the imaginations or childhood visions of God that really was never true to begin with. Let me see if I can prove that in just as quickly a way as possible to you. How did the Christian religion begin? Was it not with a very good person, in fact, the very best person who ever lived, suffering the most horrible thing that could ever happen to a person? Jesus dies on the cross. Now, who told you that if you're a good person, God will make sure nothing bad ever happens in your life? Does Christianity tell us that? Did the Apostle Paul and the other apostles who went out preaching in the days of the Roman Empire, preaching the gospel of Christ, did they tell people, follow the guardrail Jesus and he will make sure nothing bad happens in your life? They did not. You can read the record yourself. they go around and they tell people, look, you become a Christian, you're still going to face all the same kind of hardships and trials that the rest of the world is, and given the set of circumstances that were prevalent in the Roman Empire, you're also going to suffer persecution from those who oppose you. And so they were burned at the stake. They were crucified like Jesus. They were fed to lions in the Roman Colosseum. They suffered all kinds of terrible things. And if they had been promised that nothing bad was going to happen to them if they followed guardrail Jesus, then Christianity would have died before it ever got started. If you left God because you believed that He was a guardrail God, because somebody told you that, I want to tell you, you left an idol, and Paul says that's a good thing. You should leave that God. I congratulate you on walking away from Him. But don't confuse Him with the God of the Bible. There's another God that we often have in our minds as children growing up that doesn't hold true. And it's very similar to guardrail God, but sort of on the positive end of the same coin. It's not the other side of the coin. It's just the positive end of the same side, whatever in the world that analogy was meant to convey. The other end of the same spectrum, genie God. This is the God who responds to fair and reasonable requests. Fair and reasonable requests. You're not asking to be rich and famous. You're just asking for a date. Or maybe it's not. You're not even just asking for a date for you. You're not that selfish. You're asking for a date for your son, for your daughter. You're just asking for a decent job. And genie God's job is to make sure that, again, if you do the right things, He will respond in the right way. You do A, He does B. So I'm loyal to God. I try to do these right things. And then He's bound by some sort of agreement to provide for me the good things that I'm looking for in life. Not crazy things, not outlandish things, just fair and reasonable kinds of things. We may think of Him also as bargain God. I'll do this and you do that. So you prayed. You prayed for decent things, for good things, for fair and reasonable things, and nothing happened. Or at least you kind of got to the point you realized, you know, it doesn't seem to make any difference if I ask genie God or I don't ask genie God. Good or bad things seem to come my way about the same either way. And so finally, you just kind of let Him drift away, and you walked away from genie God. And I would say to you again that that's a good thing. Good riddance to genie God. I don't think He's the God of the Bible. Now, thirdly, you may have had a childish conception of affirm me God. This one can actually stay with people for quite a while in their lives. But this is the God who affirms the goodness of every moral decision that I happen to make. This is the God who is so desperate for your affection that He will never tell you no to anything that you want. And so you go through life and you say, you know, God, is it okay for me to cheat on this exam? And He says, well, you know, you've been sick a lot this semester and, you know, we're just kind of be leveling things out. So I think it's okay a little bit for you to carry that cheat sheet in on this exam. Thank you. Thank you, affirm me, God. What about, is it okay for me to move in with my boyfriend? Well, didn't he say he loves you? And after all, isn't love the most important thing in the world? And so, you know, normally I might be opposed to that kind of thing, but in your circumstance, I think that's okay. So thank you, affirm me, God. Is it okay for me to leave my wife? I mean, she nags me constantly. And affirm me, God says, only I know how much you've put up with. And though I'm ordinarily against this kind of thing, in your case, go ahead. You've suffered enough. And so it really doesn't matter what you do. This kind of God, whether you're angry, bitter, lazy, it doesn't matter. He will always be with you, and He will always be with you to tell you it's okay. Now, this kind of sounds good to us at first. We like affirm me, God, and it's natural that we would, huh? It's like a young lady who has a boyfriend who seems so nice. And he is so nice. He's so nice, in fact, that after a few months, she's kind of sick of him because she's lost all respect for him. Because he never tells her no. He always just goes all right along with anything and everything that she wants to do. He has no spine. He has no backbone. He has no will for himself. And so she's bored with him and she leaves him behind. And that can happen with people who have affirm me God and worship affirm me God. Because after a while they begin to realize he doesn't ever stand up against me. What good is a God who never directs me, who never contradicts the way that I want to go myself? Especially then when we begin to find out that a lot of the decisions that he affirmed us in turned out not to be in my best interest. Things didn't actually turn out nearly as well with that as I thought they were going to. And so we distance ourselves from affirm me God. And my suggestion is the more distance you can get from him, the better. Then on the this is the other side of the coin. This is the opposite end of the scale. Is guilt me God. This is the God who is impossible to please. This God is never happy. This is the God, he may love you in some odd kind of way, but he doesn't like you. This is the God who may love you, but the chances of you ever going to heaven are between slim and none. This is the God whose default is set to no. This is the God who takes away with one hand what he gives with the other. This is the God of the technicalities and fine print. This is the God who is the prosecuting attorney who is constantly finding fault with everything you say and turning it back against you, who catches everything that's wrong and blows it up. And so we have guilt me God. And no wonder. No wonder we decided to walk away from him. If guilt me God is the true God, then even if you went to heaven, heaven would be hell. And then there's heartthrob God. I'm not trying to be cute with these, I'm just trying to make them memorable. Heartthrob God. This is the God who you know he's there because you just have this warm feeling in your heart all the time. And those who are most susceptible to leaving heartthrob God are those who found him on the last night of Bible camp. When everybody was joined together and emotions were running high and the songs were so good, gathered around the campfire and the experience was so rich and so mountaintop that I found God in that experience. And then somewhere along the way, those feelings subsided. I have some experience personally with heartthrob God. When I decided to become a Christian, I was 9 years old, vacationing with my family in Wyoming at the Grand Tetons. And to this day, I can still remember just being in absolute awe of the glory and the beauty and the power and the majesty of the nature that was surrounding me. And coming to a conviction that I wanted to be a Christian, and then waited to get home from the trip to tell my parents. And I expected then, when I went to meet the preacher in the middle of the week to be baptized, that I was going to have sort of rekindling of that same experience when I was baptized, that I would come out of the waters and it would be just this dynamic, amazing feeling of glory and wonder. But I didn't. In fact, it reminds me of the story of Jesus. He was baptized immediately into the wilderness to be tempted of Satan. I immediately underwent feelings of temptation and darkness. I assumed that having a sense of God's presence was a proof of God's presence, which implied that not having a sense of God's presence was a proof of his absence or non-existence. And I'm not trying to make an argument in this sermon for God so much as I'm trying to clear away the undergrowth. But before we leave this point, isn't it the case the things that are most constant are the things that we are the least aware of in life? I mean, how many of you came in the room this morning or you're sitting there in the pew right now thinking, it's so airy in here. Have you noticed there's so much air? You probably haven't thought that all day long or weeks or maybe months or years or ever. But yet, does that mean that there's no air because you're not thinking about how airy it is in this place? Did you wake up this morning and grab the sides of your bed? Or maybe you feel like now like you need to grab the pew because you feel like you're on a sphere that is spinning while going 67,000 miles per hour orbiting the sun? You are, by the way, if you didn't know that. You are riding a cosmic tilt-a-whirl. But you probably don't feel like it most of the time. The fact that we don't feel it all the time doesn't mean that it isn't real. So if you walked away from Heartthrob God because you didn't have this constant sense, blissful sense of God's presence, then God never promised you that. And that's something I meant to say all the way through these, is that where did we get the idea that God was going to be these things? Now, they're caricatures is what they are, aren't they? Because there's sort of an element of truth in each of them. Isn't it true that God does protect us? I think God protects us all the time in ways we probably have no idea about. But it doesn't mean He never makes the promise that I will never let anything bad happen to you. And when I talk about genie God, I'm not saying that God never provides or gives us anything. He most certainly does. He gives us far more than we realize. But it doesn't mean that He's under some sort of bond, like a genie in the bottle, to grant us the good and noble wishes that we desire. And on the list could go. It's not that all of these things have no truth to them at all, but it's that they become caricatures of the real thing. And we have this childish understanding of God that doesn't develop, it doesn't mature, it doesn't grow, and then we are disillusioned and disappointed, and we end up walking away not from the real God that is revealed to us in Scripture and in the face of Jesus Christ, but in some distorted view of God that we have developed and that has not matured. And I want you to consider that as we look at those gods, none of those things that we have considered really are evidence against the existence of God, but they are this. They are unmet expectations. There was a thing that we wanted God to be, or a thought that we had that God should be, and when God didn't live up to that expectation that I had imagined that this is how God should be? What did Paul say back in Acts 17? These idols were things that men had imagined God to be. And then when we imagine God to be a certain way and the reality is He's not that way, we become disillusioned, disappointed, and we think, well, God as a whole is just not worth my time or confidence. I think this is something that happens to all of us. At some point in our life, we're all going to be faced with realities and experiences of life that are going to challenge the conception that we have of God, and we have to, at that point, really do some hard thinking. This happens to all of us. Just a couple of quick examples, and we'll wrap up this morning. John the Baptist, Jesus' older cousin, had come, as the prophet said, to prepare the way for Jesus. So he's blazing the trail. He's preparing the way and heralding and announcing that the long-awaited Messiah of the Jews was coming. So he was sent to the Jewish people to tell them, hey, all that the prophets have been talking about through these ages that have been recorded in our Jewish scriptures, these are now coming to fulfillment, and Jesus is the one. That's what he's preaching. He's the one who baptized Jesus. But then he was also a very courageous man, and he confronted Herod, the most ruthless and powerful man in the land at his time. Because he confronted Herod and his wife Herodias, he was put in jail. And that didn't square with John's expectations for what would happen when the Messiah came. All the Jews, John included, thought that when the Messiah came and he, having this exalted position of being the herald of the coming king, that the Messiah would come and exalt the status of the Jews. That the Romans who had been oppressing them would be driven out. And that everything is going to go great for those of us who are loyal to the king. So this is John's expectation. But instead, what's happened? He finds himself in prison. And so it says, when John heard in prison about the deeds of Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him. So John's in prison. He sends his messengers to Jesus with this question that's underlined. Are you the one who is to come? Or shall we look for another? John's expectations just had not been met. Jesus then describes some things that were actually very different than what they would expect to happen when the Messiah shows up. But the last sentence that Jesus speaks there is this: blessed is the one who's not offended by me, who doesn't stumble over me, whose sense and imagination of what I was supposed to be when I came, what God is supposed to be for you, doesn't match up with who He actually is. Our job is to learn who He actually is and learn to relate to Him as He has come to relate to us, not to force Him into the mold of our expectation. All the disciples then were crushed when Jesus died, because that was the last thing they expected to happen when the Messiah came, was that He would die a humiliating death on the cross. And so when Jesus dies, their hopes are they're just crushed. None of them are expecting Jesus to rise again to life. And they couldn't believe it when some of them started claiming, "We've seen Him." In fact, one of them didn't believe it for an entire week. And so in John, the 20th chapter, in verse 14, 24 through 29, we hear about this man named John, Thomas, who the rest of the disciples are coming to and saying, "We have seen the risen Christ. We, your brothers that you know, your friends who you have trusted, you've walked along here with us. We're telling you, Thomas, we saw Jesus alive." And Thomas says, "No way. No way." And he maintained his disbelief for a full week. And then Jesus confronts him. And He says to Thomas, "Take your hands and touch the nail marks in my hands, and reach here where the spear was thrust into my side, and stop doubting and believe." And when Thomas saw it, he said, "My Lord and my God." So the testimony changed this man, and that's what we're going to talk about next week. Next Sunday, we're going to talk about Jesus' resurrection. And if you are here again this morning, you're thinking, how could you possibly believe in this world that someone died and rose to life again? Someone literally rose from the dead. How could you believe that? That is the question, isn't it? And I hope that you'll come back next week and we'll consider the evidence, the testimony, because that's what it is. It's not just a theoretical concept of resurrection. What we're going to see is that there are people, credible witnesses, testifying under all kinds of circumstances, "We saw Jesus Christ alive after He was executed." And I hope that you'll come back to hear that, because if you don't, what I think you're doing is you're settling. You're settling for the belief that death wins. Death has the final word. That this world is, and the nature of it is all there is. And very soon, the sun's going to burn out. This planet's going to stop spinning and it's going to stop orbiting. Everything's going to collapse back into itself. And there was no one there to see it. Every love, every hate, every feeling, every thought, every accomplishment that you've ever achieved will be erased. And it will be as if it never happened and none of it ever matters. Now, I'll grant you, that's depressing. And the fact that it's depressing doesn't mean that there's a resurrection. But I hope that at least you will give as much thought to the consequences of what doubt actually means. And what that kind of fully embracing that kind of doubt will mean over time in a culture that embraces it. In contrast to a culture that believes, no, there is a God. He has come. He has conquered death. And there is hope.
hope for all of us. Don't settle. At least come and hear the evidence. If you're not a Christian this morning, we would love to pray with you, talk with you, study with you, show you more about who Jesus is, so that you can perhaps consider that evidence and make a decision as to whether you want to be his disciple. If you're not there yet, but you are intrigued and you want to come back, as I said at the beginning, you are welcome to be here. And we hope that you will come. If there's something we can do for you now, we would encourage you to let us know. And we're going to stand at this time and we're going to sing. And if you want to come and ask for a prayer or express your desire to become a Christian and be baptized, we're ready to help you in any way that we can. So why don't you let that be known while we stand and while we sing.